You got into the safety business because you wanted to protect people. But somewhere along the way, the job started controlling your time, your schedule, your priorities, even your income potential. What if the expertise you've built over the years in the field can give you something more? More freedom, more control, more ownership of your future. I'm Sheldon Primus, the author of 7 Steps to Starting a Profitable Safety Consulting Business and the host of the Safety Consultant Podcast, with more than 350 episodes helping safety professionals become consultants and grow their career. Consulting changed my life. In fact, I'm a full-time RVer and one consulting contract paid for my home I live in today. Now, I help safety professionals build their own consulting practice through bi-weekly coaching calls, accountability, and personal guidance. But this program isn't for everyone. Start with the consultant readiness audit at sheldon.coach.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion, the book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all 3 books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live, inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the Signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.
How's everybody doing there? It is Safety Wars for Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. How's everybody doing? How did you enjoy our watch party last night? On Rumble, a lot of people, what I find out is that, just like with the Christmas album, a lot of people are interested in what we do here. If not, just to see what we're doing, either out of curiosity, or they really don't like They're really not looking for all that production, all that TV stuff, right? On TV, what happens? Television, the traditional networks, and even the cable networks, the whole alphabet soup, you get all this commentary, and then they listen, you're watching them, and they say, well, this is what you just saw. This is what you just saw. I like to listen to the live feeds. I like to watch live feeds now that we're able to on this show. And I like to do it with other people. And I did give some commentary. I didn't interrupt. I waited for the applause, except for a couple of instances. And gave maybe a little bit of history and things of that nature, especially in the first hour. Now, once the first hour was over, I had to go and run and do some other stuff. But I came back at the end, and I also released the Democrat response for it. Not too many people watched it at 12 midnight, but I will say this much. There is such a thing as being too produced. There is such a thing as being too good in this medium here. In the spoken word, let me share this little story with you. I was out at a late night Bible study, and I got home at like 1 o'clock in the morning. And it was going in, and I worked all week. Sunday morning, I go into church for the 8 a.m. service, and I am the reader for the day. So if you're not familiar with a liturgical type of church, they have traditional liturgy, meaning Lutheran church, you go in, and it's very similar to the Novus Ordo service for the Catholics. And you have readers up there. Oh, the first lesson of the Old Testament you read, then the epistle lesson you read, and then the gospel, the minister or whoever is leading the congregation that day reads that and gives the sermon. And it was rather lengthy first and second lesson that day. And of course, I forget to bring the large print edition, because at that point, that was before I had LASIK surgery and I needed glasses. I forgot to bring the glasses. I forgot to bring the large print edition and everything else. Right. I'm up there and it's like, and I get about two or three sentences and I said, I'm sorry, I'm having a bad day here. I'm going to go and start all the way from the beginning. So I started all the way from the beginning and read it all through perfect. End of the service, I had people coming up to me. They said, wow, you made a mistake. I said, you made a mistake. And, because you made a mistake and you did that, nothing really bad happened. That means I'm going to go up there and I'm going to be a reader next time. And I'm going to start doing it. I feel more comfortable with that. With doing that. You did it. You made it. And you came back and you recovered. It was a big hit. They were talking about it for months. And that's the way it is. Oftentimes in this medium, podcasting, radio, what have you. The great Jay Allen on his live show, the Rated R Safety Show. You go and you watch it on Safety FM, Rated R Safety Show, and on various platforms. Every once in a while, there's a mistake. It allows me to make a mistake. He hits the wrong button. Something doesn't work with audio. And it allows me, and I'm like, okay, great. And that's the thing. People like to watch you in that struggle a little bit because it makes you more real. Doesn't make you more fake, it makes you more real. With the Democratic response, as far as the content was last night, was the governor of Virginia, what was her name? Scheinberg, Governor Scheinberg from Virginia? Governor Abigail Spanberger. All right. The other name was somebody, right? So with her, I'm not even going to comment on the content, just the delivery. It was too well produced. And, with the clapping and everything else, everything was on cue. Not sincere. And one of the things, whether you love him or you hate him, you cannot deny that Trump has some sincerity in there. At least that's the way he comes across. And that's what made him makes him relatable to 50% of the country with that. At least during the election, 50% of the country was that he seemed a little bit more real, a little bit less produced. So what do we have here? I have an article I just came across by, let me not foul that name up, Corey Pitzer. He's the CEO of SafeMap and RiskMap, co-founder of Safety on the Edge. You can check him out on LinkedIn. I came across this article on LinkedIn. And if you recall, a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to Todd Conklin on this via text on here. He's also internationally recognized safety professional. Where people are out there, HOP doesn't work. And they're always defending safety one. Well, HOP doesn't work. This guy gives Corey Pitzer gives a little bit of a, does a really good job explaining his point of view with this and We're going to go into that right after our brief introduction.
Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And here we are on the other side of the intro. Let me get that article up here for all of us to read together. Again, I'm using this under fair use guidelines. And we're going to be commenting, no doubt, in the middle of this. So this is for commentary and for all also educational purposes with that. Right? Get off your knees, safety professionals. All right, so this is an article here, and here's the article here. So Neil deGrasse Tyson once used a powerful analogy. Imagine trying to estimate the population of the sharks and whales in the ocean by dipping a bucket into water. You could dip that bucket a million times over a million years, and you still may never catch a whale. That doesn't mean that whales don't exist. It means your measurement tool is inadequate for the phenomenon you're trying to observe. Perfect thing with Hop here, right? In safety, we may be doing something similar. We're trying to measure whales with a bucket. A common criticism of HOP, human organizational performance, is that there is insufficient evidence that it reduces injury rates. The challenge is often framed in straightforward terms. And I'll add, these are common terms that we all deal with, right? If HOP works, there's measurable decline in total recordable incident rate, LTIFR, right? Or recordable injury frequency. At first glance, this appears to be a reasonable demand for empirical rigor. But the framing of the question reveals deeper delusions about how safety performance is conceptualized. We were talking about a guy like this a couple weeks ago, weren't we? Measured and interpreted. Before asking whether HOP reduces injury rates, we must examine whether injury rates are the appropriate dependent variable for evaluating a cultural and systemic intervention. That's what I said a couple of weeks ago, where you cannot come up with a matrix so easily on why is someone acting like an AH, and you know what that means. The problem with safety metrics. Injury frequency is a lagging indicator. It tells us harm occurred after controls failed or exposure accumulated. It says nothing about how resilient the system was before that moment. In most organizations, injury rates are also KPIs that must be driven down. That creates predictable pressures. Underreporting becomes tempting. Classification thresholds get stretched. Medical management decisions influence numbers. Workforce size changes distort rates. Workforce size changes distort rates, right? Low base rate events create statistical noise. Where have we heard that before? Jay Allen, in his book, The Signal Transmission Trilogy. In low injury environments, small random variations can create dramatic swings and draw causal conclusions from those swings is misplaced at best. When HOP is introduced, it doesn't directly target injury counts. It targets upstream factors. Leadership, behavior, learning systems, reporting climate, system design, expecting immediate linear changes in downstream injury statistics, misunderstands the causal distance involved. There are many layers of distortions between leadership behavior and the injury in outcomes, meaning that you have injuries on one end and on a leadership on the other end with it. Embedded operational procedures, regulatory definition and reporting requirements, governments, and the metrics that drive what gets done. The list is endless, yet critics of hops simply fail to acknowledge that. What Hop intends to change. Hop's core commitments include, and these are five things, according to this author. Viewing error as information rather than structural failure. Reducing blame as a default response. Encouraging reporting of weak signals and near misses. Exploring systemic contributors to performance variability. Strengthening learning loops. These shifts alter how organizations process information about risk. If implemented effectively, HOP should increase the visibility of operational realities. What I pointed out was, if your financial stuff is being hidden, that could be a felony. That could be, you can have all different types of problems, especially if it's a publicly traded company and in, privately traded also, I'm told. But why do we hide all this crap when it comes to safety? We're with that. Workers may report near misses. Minor injuries may be classified more accurately. Control weaknesses may surface earlier. Production pressures and trade-offs may be discussed more candidly. That's what we're doing. In such circumstances, reported incident rates may, not should, rise. There is widespread evidence that of that. And it's not evidence of deterioration. It is evidence of increased transparency. So my question always is to these folks, are you, would you rather know about the accident or would you rather, or the incident or the risk or anything else? Or do you want to hear about it later on? When do you want to hear about it? Because there's a good chance you're going to hear it later on and it's going to be a summons in the mail that some subcontractor is suing you. The reporting paradox. There is a well-documented phenomenon across high reliability sectors. Higher reporting often correlates with safer long-term performances. Aviation and healthcare reporting systems illustrate this clearly. Organizations with robust, non-punitive reporting cultures tend to generate large volumes of safety data and reporting rates. They are not less safe, they are more active in challenging themselves. Moreover, low injury numbers can coexist with high latent risk in low trust environments. And there is abundant evidence of that to be found in highly publicized industrial disasters. If HOP reduces fear and increases voice, an early phase characterized by elevated reported incidents should not be surprising. In fact, in environments where such data has been driven down, such has been happening in many organizations. Let me repeat that. If HOP reduces fear and increases voice, an early phase characterized by elevated reported incidents should not be surprising. In fact, in environments where such data has been driven down, such has been happening in many organizations with VBS, not all, many, it is ideal that injury rates reporting should go up. Does evidence exist? Critics often argue that there are no randomized controlled trials demonstrating that HOP reduces injuries. It's true that we don't have randomized controlled trials proving that HOP reduces injuries, but large-scale controlled experiments and complex socio-technical systems are rare across the board, including in VBS, who often report on studies as evidence that are highly susceptible to uncontrolled confounding factors. However, while direct experimental evidence may be limited, the underlying mechanisms of HOP are strongly supported by adjoining research domains. Right? And he lists five things. Psychological safety research demonstrates that teams with higher interpersonal trust report more errors and learn more effectively. Safety climate meta-analysis, meaning you get a whole bunch of studies and you make a study of the studies, link leadership commitment and reporting openness to injury outcomes over time. High reliability organization research shows that preoccupation with failure and reluctance to simplify interpretations correlate with improved risk management. So let me repeat that. High reliability organization research shows that preoccupation with failure and reluctance to simplify interpretations correlate with improved risk management. So in other words, you got to look into things. That's what the author is talking about. Just culture studies illustrate how blame reduction improves reporting and learning behaviors. Organizational learning theory consistently connects feedback richness to adaptive performance. The causal chain implied by Hoff is indirect but coherent. Four things: leadership climate, and again, we teach about leadership here. Leadership climate influences reporting behavior. Reporting behavior influences risk discovery. Risk discovery enables control correction, and control correction influences exposure to serious harm. Right? Hoff intervenes primarily in the early stages of this chain. The absence of short-term injury reduction does not negate the validity of Hoff and indicates that measurement horizons may be misaligned with intervention targets. The link between Hoff and injury rates is simply impossible to make, even though most VBS pundits hate to hear that. Injury frequency, especially serious injury or fatality events, are too infrequent to register statistically significant shifts within short observation windows. If I was everybody, and if I were a safety person, I would go right now and start writing down this stuff and making it into phrases when people when you're faced with systemic problems, so you could go and have these talking points. What's the point here? Hoff is at the beginning before you right. That's where the concentration is: preventing injuries. Preventing injury, preventing change in color, cultures. After the bang, right, left and right of the bang thinking here, right? After the bang, and you're on the right side of that bang, that's where you don't want to be. Hoff does address that too. They want to know what the hell happened, number one. Number two, let's not worry about blaming people. We want to find out what happened. We're not looking for the person did this, and therefore the person is evil, and we need to get a new person. Organizations out there still do that today. We'll continue with the argument, with the article. This raises an important methodical issue. When evaluating systemic interventions, we must consider other indicators of system integrity, not solely lagging indicators of harm. Examples of measures and signals include risk discovery and reduction rates. That's where your good catches are, right? Risk discovery and reduction rates. Frequency of identified control failures. Ratio of hideable versus non-hideable risk reporting. Time to correction metrics. Ratio of behavior versus systemic risk of observations, ratio of critical control failures, a P fatality, meaning high impact, versus P injury, low impact risk. These indicators improve under Hoff implementation when the organization's exposure profile may be declining, even if injury statistics fluctuate, remain plateaued, or rise. It is, or it should be, well known that an over-reliance on injury frequency as a primary proof of effectiveness can perverse incentives. When leaders are evaluated predominantly on low injury numbers, pressures typically arise to minimize recordability, reinterpret classifications, or discourage reporting. In this context, demanding that Hoff demonstrate immediate injury reduction illustrates an inability or unwillingness of the challengers to move beyond the myopia of metrics. How does Hoff increase injuries? It is sometimes asserted that Hoff increases injuries because reported rates rise following implementation. This interpretation confuses recorded events with actual harm prevalence. If underreporting was previously present, improved transparency will elevate recorded numbers. That's true. On that. My experience bears that out. This is not an increase in harm occurrence. It's an increase in harm detection. Over time, if control quality improves and exposure is reduced, serious injury potential should decline. However, this effect may be gradual and masked by reporting dynamics. Many organizations claim to apply the HOP framework, still maintain old view metrics and governance that drives the opposite of intention of HOP. A little bit of disagreement here. We are forced by contract, especially if you are dealing with organizations, oil companies, chemical plants, pharmaceuticals that are obsessed with statistics, and they have to show these statistics, they have to justify those statistics that they've been recording for 30 years, right? And by contract, organizations like the Army Corps of Engineers require a lot of this stuff. They require the reporting of that stuff. So, by contract, why do serious injury and fatality rates remain stubbornly high? We're back to the article. It is often asserted that SIF rates, severe serious injury and fatality rates, are not reducing, plateauing, or even increasing. There is no universal truth to the claims. In the USA, fatality rates are declining. In Canada, not. Europe, generally stable, and Australia, declining. In some sectors, yes, in others, no. And a blanket blame of HOP is short-sighted and myopic. If a company claims it's following HOP principles on the website, it is a far cry from effectively deploying them. That's an indictment right there. This lack of impact does not lie within the scope or intent of HOP. It lies within entrenched KPIs, key performance indicators, and governance of the organization that continue to drive a focus on safety outcomes, a term that even pundits of HOP can't escape, and fail to see its degenerative impact on systems and culture. Reframing the debate. The debate about HOP and injury reduction often reveals a deeper tension within the safety profession. One paradigm equates safety with the absence of recorded harm. The other conceptualizes safety as the presence of adaptive capacity. HOP accuses VBS of simplification. VBS accuses HOP of word salads. If safety is defined purely as low injury frequency, then any intervention must demonstrate numerical decline to be validated. Let's repeat that. If safety is defined purely as low injury frequency, then any intervention must demonstrate numerical decline to be validated. If safety is defined as the ability to anticipate, monitor, respond, and learn, then measurement must expand beyond outcome counts. HOP aligns more closely with the broader framing of what safe is, and for that, word salads are inevitable. A more appropriate question. Instead of asking whether HOP reduces injury rates in the short term, a more meaningful inquiry is this. Does HOP increase the organization's ability to see risk before harm occurs? Does it accelerate the identification and correlation of control weaknesses? Does it strengthen systemic learning? Does it reduce the overall reliance on blame as a regulatory mechanism? Over extended and valid timeframes, does serious injury exposure decrease as control quality improves? Conclusion. The demand for evidence that HOP reduces injury rates is understandable. Evidence matters. However, evidence must be sought in alignment with the theory of change being evaluated. HOP intervenes in leadership, behavior, reporting climate, and learning architecture. Its first order effect is increased transparency. Its second order effect is improved control integrity. Only at a third order level should we expect measurable shifts in serious harm outcomes. And for the third order level, the onus is on the safety profession to develop and deploy the methods, techniques, and tools to do that. And again, yes, the HOP principles are not new, as it never existed before we invented a new wheel. HOP never claimed that. It evolved from the 1980s and 90s from the work of Peru, Rasmussen, Reason, Leader Woods, Hall Nagel, Decker, and more prominently, Todd Conklin, friend of our show, and the Department of Energy. Edward Deming's 14 principles in the late 1980s are closely aligned with Hop principles. Maybe the lack of earlier traction was because it was stalled and stymied by the success of BBS, which offered simpler, simplistic tools and slogans. We can love those freaking sloganeering stuff, right? BBS was successful, but we must ask, successful with what? An easy recipe that appealed more to operational managers' need for short-term impact and evidence that can be captured in a triangle and an ABC acronym. Yes, BBS has those in abundance and showed measurable success and driven down metrics or with the help of halo effect at best. The more substantive challenge for the safety profession is not whether HOP reduces injury rates, but whether our measurement frameworks are sophisticated enough to detect meaningful system improvement when it occurs. Right? Highlight that. Come up with the phrases. The man is giving you your words. Use them here. That is a deliberation worth having, and it extends well beyond HOP itself. As it stands now, yes, HOP does not have many of these practical levers added in its arsenal yet. So just the reality of that. As paradigms and frameworks evolve, like they are now, many of the old tools and techniques are and will become obsolete. The energy should not go on how we can hang on to them, but how we can evolve them too, and so too how we measure our success or failure. BBS had an 80-year run during which methods of measurement solidified. That era has been superseded by the evolution of new thinking in the past 10 or 15 years and still evolving. BBS pundits have a choice. Remain knee-deep in the horse guvno because, I said that, guvno, or he says horse manure, because you can't stand these new horseless carriages, or adapt, and contribute to the growth of the safety profession. Some thought leaders of BBS have led the way, like Tom Krause has done, but it seems that many of the followers remain unwilling. Right? And then there's a thing there, and let's see what this is. That is an article by Corey Pitzer on LinkedIn. Yes, and I know I need to get looking at those notifications here. Phenomenal thing. I'm going to tag him on it. Maybe we get him on the show. Really good with this. And I'm going to say we did an in-depth dive into your article on Safety Wars this evening. We'll send you a link. Phenomenal, right? And we're also going to do a screenshot on this also and download the article. I tell you what, I'm going to take a break here because I need to after that. Man, I'm all worked up here. Think I was going to take a nap. No, not so quick, Safety Warriors. We are out here.
Safety Wars is streaming now.
SafetyFM.com.
Have you listened or watched the Safety War show? It does stream live on the radio and on the streamers that we have. So if you have not taken a listen to Jim Bozell and what the hell he's doing every evening with Safety Wars, I would strongly encourage you to take a view or take a listen, whichever option is available for you, and take a listen to what the hell he has going on. It will take some deep dives and some information that you might be interested in.
In an unpredictable world, one voice rises above the chaos. Meet Jim Bozell, a seasoned safety expert who's navigated through some of the most dangerous scenarios, from anthrax, explosive cleanups, disasters, and numerous environmental cleanups, and lived to tell the tale. Now he's bringing his wealth of knowledge, insights, and experiences to you through Safety Wars. From workplace hazards to the hidden dangers in your own home, Jim covers it all with his engaging storytelling. Safety Wars isn't just a podcast. It's your guide to a safer world. Join Jim Pozo and become part of the Safety Wars revolution. Available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts and videos. Safety Wars. Your safety is our mission.
OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Pozel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy!
Yes, I got some complaints. I'm remiss. I didn't play that recently. But anyway, I got to spend some time at home. The project I'm on went into hiatus. With the weather, the wonderful weather out here in the Northeast. I tell you what, it's been, it has not been easy, folks. It has not been easy at all. All right. U.S. Department of Labor announces $81 million to support, and this is a press release today, employment for formerly incarcerated individuals. We've gone over this numerous times here. So at NJC, New Jersey City University, soon to be Kane University, they, I was involved with the reentry program, and I had some discussions with the former governor, Jim McGreevy, on this also, who's also involved in the reentry program. I tell you what, some of the biggest at-risk people out there in our workforce are these folks here. Why? Nobody will hire them. So they end up going to bad companies, low pay, and who don't give a darn about safety out there. And that, right? And they're like, the thing is, well, no one else will hire you. I'll hire you, and I'll pay you minimum wage, and you're going to like it. I'm going to give you a Gouvernail sandwich here. And that's what happens. And oftentimes, they end up having to start their own companies. And now they're self-employed, and guess what? OSHA doesn't apply to self-employed people. Happens. Because then you could get, then they say, well, no, you're not hiring Frank here, who's been in prison. You're hiring Frank's Industrial Services. And I'm just throwing that out of the air, you know, with that. There may be a Frank Industrial Service. I'm not talking to them. I just made that up. The U.S. Department of Labor announced the availability of $81 million in grant funding to assist people reentering their communities after being incarcerated. By helping them gain experience and secure employment in skilled trades and high-demand industries, the reentry employment skill trades, advanced manufacturing, registered apprenticeships, and training, wow, that's a mouthful, initiative grants will enable organizations to provide training programs with that. So they shortened it as Restart, and administered by the Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration. I'm doing a share screen right there. Right, apprenticeship.gov. Tools, that's dol.gov/agencies/ETA. This I got to send to a friend of mine here. U.S. Department of Labor recovers $409,000 in back wages from Little Caesars franchise operator for 32 workers. Pizza, right? That used to be their in their commercials. The U.S. Department of Labor has reached a settlement agreement with the operator of Little Caesars restaurant in Redwood City to pay $409,457 in back wages to workers after investigation the employer failed to pay them required minimum wage and overtime in violation of federal wage law. My question is, are they illegal immigrants working there with that? And what's their story? For all I know, they may be people right out on that we just talked about that were formerly incarcerated. The agreement follows investigation by the department's wage and hour division that found franchise operator violated minimum wage and overtime provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act between May 2022 and May 2025. The division found that the employer failed to pay employees time and one-half overtime rates for all hours worked over 40 in a work week, but instead paid them straight time for those hours. In addition, the employer neglected to pay some employees for all hours worked resulting in minimum wage violations. The investigation also found FLSA record-keeping violations, including discrepancies between timesheet totals and payroll records. All workers must be paid for every hour they work, including overtime premiums, when they work more than 40 hours in a work week, said Wage and Hour Division Acting Director, District Director Michael Eastwood in San Jose, California. The Wage and Hour Division will continue to enforce federal law and help ensure workers receive wages they earn. With that. Wow. That's a lot. We're going to... Okay, here's another one I missed here. U.S. Department of Labor finds Denver area restaurant employed minors to load hazardous equipment work outside of legally allowed hours. A U.S. Department of Labor investigation of a full-service restaurant in Aurora, area that I'm very familiar with, found the employer violated federal child labor law and denied 19 chefs, kitchen staff, and other workers their earned overtime pay. The department's Wage and Hour Division found that I'm not going to mention a name because this is a very popular name for hibachi restaurants, right? Violated child labor provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act by allowing a 17-year-old to load a trash compactor, a hazardous task prohibited by for workers under 18. Investigators also, maybe I need to do another child labor law program. Investigators also found the employer allowed 14 workers ages 14 to 15 to work later than longer hours than permitted by law. Under federal law, children ages 14 to 15 may not work later than 7 p.m. between the day after Labor Day and May 31st or after 9 p.m. from June 1st to Labor Day, and they cannot work more than 8 hours per day on a non-school day. The investigation also revealed the employer failed to pay time and one-half overtime rates to some employees for all hours worked over a 40-hour work week, instead paying them straight time. The restaurant also failed to pay some employees any wages for overtime hours worked, and all overtime violations result in the recovery of $20,213 back wages. Restaurants have a clear legal duty to pay their employees for all hours worked, including overtime, and to provide a safe experience for young workers. The Wage and Hour Division is committed to protecting minors and ensuring employers meet their obligations under the Fair Labor Standards Act, said Wage and Hour District Director David Skinner. The employer has paid $22,249 in civil money penalty for the child labor violations in addition to the back wages. Department of Labor's Youth Rules Initiative provides information, and we'll be visiting that. With that, and also, they have 7 child labor best practices for employers linked for that. So check it out on the website. See what they're doing. EPA completes elemental mercury cleanup on this. And as I pointed out to some, most of this stuff on that I read here and I cover, this is like the first read here for this. So you're getting my raw reaction and visceral reaction to every one of these stories here. The US EPA has completed the cleanup of elemental mercury from a residence in Valley Park, Missouri, after receiving a report that a resident has filled mercury at their home. On January 31st, 2026, the Valley Park Fire Protection District responded to a 911 call from a concerned resident after they spilled elemental mercury, also called metallic mercury, aka quicksilver, in their home. After arriving on scene, securing and containerizing 3 vials of elemental mercury, the Valley Park Fire Protection District informed Missouri Department of Natural Resources, MoDNR, about the spill. At the request of MoDNR, EPA Region 7 cleaned up the spilled elemental mercury in the home to prevent further spread of mercury off-site. An on-scene coordinator confirmed the presence of liquid elemental mercury inside the home. Mercury vapor levels inside the residence were observed to exceed the indoor air residential removal action goals of 1,000 nanograms. Right? That is 1 microgram, I guess, per meter cubed. Nanograms per meter cubed presented a health risk to the resident. EPA completed an emergency removal action to address the release of elemental mercury that was causing the elevated mercury vapor concentrations in the home. Utilizing specialized mercury removal equipment to remove the elemental mercury that had been spilled, that's a mercury vacuum, usually. Assessing and removing contaminated personnel and belongings and bulk items, heating and ventilation in the home, painting and sealing porous concrete surfaces in the basement that were impacted by mercury during the spill, and regular screening of mercury vapor concentration with portable mercury vapor analyzers. Elemental mercury is extremely difficult to clean up. Once spilled, mercury beads can scatter and settle into cracks in the floor and beyond the baseboard. Additionally, it is very tough to get mercury out of clothes, furniture, carpet, and other porous items. While small spills, such as those from vintage mercury filter thermometers, can usually be managed with proper care, individuals without proper training and equipment typically worsen the situation, put themselves and others at significant risk. For exposure, individuals should avoid using ordinary household items such as mops, paper towels, and vacuums for cleanup, as these can often spread elemental mercury throughout the homes and increase mercury vapors. Mercury can impact people's health in a variety of ways, and it depends on several factors such as form of mercury, amount of mercury, age of the person exposed, how long the exposure lasts, and how the person is exposed, and health of the person exposed. Right? Just for complete and total disclosure here, I was the site safety officer on the famous, covered by 60 Minutes, Grand Street Mercury Cleanup in Hoboken, New Jersey. You could Google it. And also the Merck Calgon Cleanup in Hawthorne, New Jersey, back in the mid-1990s on this. The biggest hazard of mercury is this. Biggest hazard, you can't smell it. A lot of people think, well, we can smell it, therefore it's, we can't smell it, therefore it's safe. Nothing can be further than the truth. Call on the professionals out there. The other thing is this. The hotter it is, the more dangerous it is because it releases more mercury vapor. And I was always there, well, I used to play with mercury and shine my coin. They used to have a coin called the penny. I used to shine my copper penny with mercury, and I never had a problem. You hear this stuff. Guess what? Not true. Not true at all. Mercury is odorless, right? The other thing is elemental mercury, pure stuff. They do have organic mercury out there, which is very, very dangerous. I've been told that even a couple of drops could kill you because it goes through your skin. So this is like one of those things here. And you can check out the EPA website. And here we have methyl mercury. That's what I'm talking about. And when inorganic mercury salts can become attached to airborne particles, rain and snow deposit these particles on land. Even as mercury gets deposited on land, it often returns to the atmosphere as a gas or associated with particles and then deposits elsewhere. As it cycles through the atmosphere, land, and water, mercury undergoes a series of complex chemical and physical transformations, many of which are not completely understood. Microscopic organisms can combine mercury with carbon, thus converting it from inorganic to organic form. Methyl mercury is the most common organic mercury compound found in the environment. Highly toxic with that. And there's been some news on the EPA website about power plants and everything else with that change in policy. EPA approves Wyoming's coal combustion residuals permit program. And let's find out what Lee Zeldin says about the State of the Union. Today, U.S. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin released the following statement on the heels of President Trump's State of the Union address. Tonight, the American people witnessed a State of the Union that was nothing short of historic. President Trump delivered a powerful vision for America's future, one centered on lowering costs for families, unleashing American energy, securing our borders, and keeping our communities safe, said Administrator Lee Zeldin. 1 year in, our nation is stronger, safer, and more affordable. America's golden age is here. With that, right? So that's what he had to say on that. We're going to go to another commercial break here, and we'll come back with you.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion. The book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all three books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the Signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.
Yeah, we're on fire tonight. We are on fire tonight. And let's go one more. This is actually one of my favorite ones. Ay, 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 it's not working.
This is going to blow your mind. There's a new daytime talk show on your local cable access station. What happens when safety, scandal, and heartbreak collide? Welcome to Safety Wars, the talk show. Today's episode is a doozy. Imagine confronting your unsafe supervisor who just happens to be your ex-wife's new hubby. Talk about a powder keg. But wait, there's more. We've got an exclusive interview with a corporate exec who's taken out life insurance policies on his riskiest workers, hoping to cash in on a deadly mishap. Yup, you heard that right. It's a real-life plot twist you can't make up. Tune in as Jim Posel, CSP, our very own Jerry Springer of Safety, dives deep into this explosive confrontation. Sparks will fly and secrets will be exposed. Catch the full episode on Safety Wars on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform. Don't miss out on the drama that could save your life. Like and share now, and stay safe, folks.
Well, here, we're going to find this very funny here, right? Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works announces Building Infrastructure, Not Paperwork initiative for the Army Civil Works program. Why do I find this a little bit... You know, you gotta just, I don't know what to say here. In the Army Corps of Engineers world, this is by contract, you have to do the paperwork. They have all different kinds of paperwork. Believe me, they got all different kinds of stuff. Paperwork has paperwork. Meetings have meetings, right? So for the fact that they're going to be concentrating on doing stuff and not so much on the paperwork, when I see it, I'll believe it, right? Today, Assistant Secretary of Armies for Civil Works, Adam Artell, announced a major initiative, Building Infrastructure, Not Paperwork, for the Civil Works Program. What is this article? This is from earlier this week on the 23rd. Building Infrastructure, Not Paperwork, will provide greater focus on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' core civil works missions while minimizing non-core programs. Direct funding to priority water resources projects that will provide the greatest benefits to the nation, shorten permitting timelines, and reduce or eliminate extraneous regulations and paperwork that slow USACE's delivery of civil works projects and programs. President Trump has empowered his administration to work with light speed efficiency. Where have we heard that before, right? Light speed efficiency to make our government deliver more for all Americans. The Army Civil Works Building Infrastructure, Not Paperwork initiative will enable the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to deliver critical projects and programs for the nation more efficiently, sooner, and at less cost than the current ways of doing business, said Dell. This will eliminate bureaucratic delays, provide fast, clear decisions needed to save lives and empower our economy. Continuous Army transformation is about rapidly delivering war-winning capabilities to the Army today, not years in the future. But that's not all. We're also transforming at home at all, too, said Secretary of the Army Dan Driscoll. I'm incredibly proud of the Building Infrastructure Not Paperwork Transformation Initiative and the Army Civil Works and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers teams recently unveiled. BINIP will rebuild and strengthen American infrastructure across our nation, increasing resiliency and providing tangible, long-lasting value for the American people. Building Infrastructure Not Paperwork will enable USACE district commanders around the nation to execute the civil works projects and programs that benefit the nation. USACE commanders will be empowered to take informed risks in advancing critical water resources projects and programs to completion faster and at less cost. The policy changes will also bring greater transparency and accountability for the program to the American public, project partners and sponsors, industry, and the elected leaders who make the annual funding decisions for the Civil Works Program. The plan consists of 27 initiatives grouped under five categories: maximizing the ability to deliver national infrastructure, cutting red tape, focus on efficiency, transparency and accountability, prioritization. The initiatives do not affect USAID's execution of its emergency response support to natural and man-made disasters. The U.S. Army Civil Works Program has been an invaluable cornerstone for more than 200 years. Building Infrastructure Not Paperwork will return USAID to a focus on its core missions and ensure the enterprise continues to be the most trusted national resource delivering water resources solutions, added Tell. This is only possible with President Trump's leadership that has enabled our team to maximize our ability to deliver national infrastructure and cut red tape for the American people. That's it, folks. Right? So what we're going to do is I'm just going to cut bait right here, and we're going to finish the program here. Hope you enjoyed it. I mean, you know, it was energetic. I like to do stuff like this. I hope to see you tomorrow. For Safety Wars and Safety FM, this is Jim Polzel signing off.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Why is that? Now, I sent that on along to my wife, and she's like, no, what? You know, we don't get it. I don't get it. Legalized safety. I said, you know what? The people who need to hear that are going to understand it. Why is safety and working safe treated like we're committing a crime? This is coming out on March 1st. Love in the Exclusion Zone. Available on Apple Music and Spotify.
exclusion zone.
You got into the safety business because you wanted to protect people, but somewhere along the way, the job started controlling your time, your schedule, your priorities, even your income potential. What if the expertise you've built over the years in the field can give you something more? More freedom, more control, more ownership of your future. I'm Sheldon Primus, the author of 7 Steps to Starting a Profitable Safety Consulting Business and the host of the Safety Consultant Podcast. With more than 350 episodes helping safety professionals become consultants and grow their career. Consulting changed my life. In fact, I'm a full-time RVer and one consulting contract paid for my home I live in today. Now, I help safety professionals build their own consulting practice through bi-weekly coaching calls, accountability, and personal guidance. But this program isn't for everyone. Start with the consultant readiness audit at sheldon.coach.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion, the book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all 3 books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.